just as Facebook was starting to take off with its soon-to-be iconic founder. Mark Zuckerberg had quit Harvard and would go to parties at Stanford, Lake recalls. That was what I thought of as an entrepreneur, someone who coded in their basement. At school, she gravitated towards economics and abandoned medical school for management consulting. After graduation, she joined the Parthenon Group, where she focused on retail and restaurants, and realized that many retail businesses either don't have or don't effectively use customer data. She then became an associate at a small venture capital firm in hopes of finding a retail startup she might like to work for. After meeting hundreds of entrepreneurs, she didn't find a single company appealing as an employer, but she also realized that not all founders actually look like Mark Zuckerberg. That was inspiration, Lake says. Finally realizing that she could simply create her own dream company, Lake went on to Harvard Business School, which is where she hatched the initial idea. She'd read about an online service that connected men to personal shoppers, and she decided to take a crack at something similar for women. She teamed up with the wife of a Stanford classmate, Erin Morrison Flynn, who had worked as a direct merchant at J. Crew, and the pair began by asking classmates, friends, and friends of friends to fill out style profiles to indicate what kind of clothing they liked and needed. Then they bought a bunch of pieces at retail on their credit cards and started delivering boxes of clothes to their first customers, who reimbursed them for the clothes they liked, leaving them to return the rest. They didn't make any money, but did get a feel for how the business could work. They could style customers to their satisfaction, even if they didn't know them personally, and even if the customers didn't recognize the brands they were receiving. Eventually, they started sending 5 items per box, which Lake refers to as their fix, because people who like the service get addicted, hence the company name, Stitch Fix. Stitch Fix started to take off thanks to an initial investment from her mentor and fellow entrepreneur, Sukhinder Singh Cassidy, whom Lake had met during an internship at Polyvore. Lake and Flynn later parted ways. "We had a good partnership, the company was scaling, and we were going in different directions," Lake tells me. Forbes reports there was an ownership dispute, a lawsuit, and a settlement, and ultimately Flynn left the company. Though Stitch Fix had successfully raised a Series A, the next round of fundraising proved much more difficult. In the fall of 2012, Stitch Fix was running out of money. Customers kept coming back, suggesting that an online personal styling service could be something big. The company needed to scale, which meant it needed cash. But even though Stitch Fix's revenue growth was promising, some 50 VCs passed on investing. Those who gave an explanation suggested they just didn't want to invest in a women-focused business or simply didn't understand the opportunity. One investor literally in the first minute said, "I don't know why anyone would ever want to receive something like this," Lake says. In a lot of cases, men aren't going to see the same thing that women see. Investors generally do see women's businesses differently than their founders do. One VC told me, "I'd love to fund more women, but I just don't want to fund another e-commerce company." This comment points to the same issue that some VCs have complained to me about privately, that too many women choose to start companies in sectors where growth is expected to be lower, such as e-commerce and parenting, rather than in areas with huge growth potential, such as artificial intelligence. A lot of low-growth businesses are viable. They just don't have the kind of enormous upside that excites investors who are successful enough to pick and choose. In 2011, Mashable reporter Jolie O'Dell tweeted, "Women, stop making startups about fashion, shopping, and babies. You're embarrassing me." Her comment triggered the typical social media uproar, but there is some truth to it. In a comprehensive survey in 2017, TechCrunch found that 31% of startups with a female founder focused on e-commerce. Other sectors popular among women were education, healthcare, and media and entertainment. But the vast majority of venture capital in 2016 went into fintech, meaning financial tech, such as apps that disrupt banking and retirement planning, security, genetics, augmented and virtual reality, and artificial intelligence, in addition to an outsized amount in transportation, dominated by funding of Uber, Lyft, and other ride-hailing services. These numbers indicate a big mismatch between ideas that attract mostly male VCs and ideas that attract female entrepreneurs. Is this a true gender gap? Maybe, but not necessarily. There's evidence to suggest that women choose lower cost of entry, lower growth sectors simply because they have fewer resources available to them. Not only are women less likely to receive venture capital than men, but they are also less likely to have business loan and credit applications approved, That said, the data also shows that women ask for smaller amounts of credit and hesitate to take on more debt. The author, Sharon Hattery, who has closely studied entrepreneurship, says men tend to set bigger goals for growth while women focus instead on making their business sustainable. Hattery believes the problem is twofold. First, you have women's own self-limiting views of themselves, their businesses, and the opportunities available to them. But equally problematic are the stereotypes, perceptions, and expectations of business leaders. Supporting Hattery's view is evidence that venture capitalists talk about male and female entrepreneurs differently. In one study of a group of investors, including 5 men and 2 women, discussing future funding decisions in Sweden, male founders were more likely to be described as young and promising, while young women were described as inexperienced. Being cautious was viewed as positive for men and negative for women. Ultimately, women were denied funding more often than men, and when they did receive it, they got 25% of the money they requested, whereas men received 52%. The data clearly also shows that when a woman walks into a pitch meeting, she's already at a disadvantage. In one study, in which women and men voiced the same slide presentations word for word without ever showing themselves, investors funded male-voiced ventures 60% more often than female-voiced ventures. When entrepreneurs presented in person, attractive men were particularly persuasive, whereas good looks didn't give a woman an extra edge, even if she said the same thing as the man who came before her. Sarah Tabaugh, a sociology professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara, has found that both male and female investors tend to have lower expectations of women entrepreneurs and systematically perceive them as less competent and skilled. Tabaugh writes in Newsweek, "On an aggregate level, this dynamic suggests countless ideas that could have blossomed into successful businesses and benefited the economy never did, simply because the individuals who pitched them weren't the right gender. This finding suggests that when a man proposes a business idea, he can typically expect others to respond on the basis of a simple risk-benefit calculation, the kind any venture capitalist might make when deciding whether to help finance a project. But when a woman proposes the same idea, she can expect others to simultaneously be looking for cues that she in fact possesses the types of skills and traits needed to make a venture a success, abilities she's often assumed to lack because of her gender. In essence, investors are prone to selling women entrepreneurs short." There is not a single woman that I can think of in this industry that is publicly labeled as a visionary or a genius, Rent the Runway CEO Jennifer Hyman told me. There are dozens and dozens of men in the country where those adjectives are used. Because we label men as geniuses and visionaries, we give them a lot more chances, we allow them to fail a lot more times, and we make excuses for things that we wouldn't make excuses for women. Unless we change the public vernacular of how we lift up and recognize women and how we all give women the same sorts of chances, we're not going to see that change. VCs will argue that many female entrepreneurs are guilty of underselling themselves. Investors have told me that women often focus on pitching their skills, data, and metrics rather than selling a big vision, something men are more comfortable doing. That vision may be grandiose and nearly impossible to achieve, but it sure sounds good. Investors want to fund outsized successes, and telling a good story is critical. That's why you'll often hear investors say they fund people instead of ideas. VCs want to believe in an entrepreneur's idea, but they want to believe even more in that entrepreneur's willingness to think big and drive to succeed at any cost. That said, if investors are already predisposed to doubt that women have what it takes to deliver a big return, would they believe a woman who said she could? VCs want to hear a visionary pitch, a story of a billion-dollar opportunity that will justify the financial risk required to make it happen. But if a woman does make a visionary pitch, VCs are prone to doubt that she will be able to bring that vision to life. With men, they are more willing to believe that the sky's the limit. On top of this, VCs generally spend years working closely with the handful of founders they've chosen to fund, helping them make the dream a reality. Given that level of commitment, it's no surprise they want to bet on companies they are truly passionate about. But here's the catch-22. Because most venture capitalists are men, they're more likely to be passionate about ideas that appeal to, well, men. When Lake was raising her seed round, she noticed that a fair number of Little League coaching apps were getting funded. I'm like, how big of a business is that? Seriously? A t-ball league? But your target audience is these VCs who manage their son's t-ball league. Blake says. There's that bias that gets introduced in terms of what people's passions are, what people's interests are, what industries people understand, and what they personally feel an affinity toward. I do think there ends up being a bias against where women are the primary opportunity. When VCs do fund women, however, they often do right by them. Julia Hartz co-founded Eventbrite with her husband Kevin, the early PayPal board member. Sequoia backed Eventbrite, and Roelof Botha joined the board. When Kevin stepped down as Eventbrite's CEO in 2016, Julia became one of the few female chief executives in Silicon Valley. You start to think, okay, there are a million different ways I could fail here, Hartz says. So you look for signs of people who are going to support you or people who are going to judge you. Sequoia definitely fell into the first category, Hartz says. She visits the firm's offices monthly to discuss strategy with Botha. I get the sense that I'm not a sideshow for them, she says. I'm not somebody that they are even trying to exploit. I'm like any other CEO, and they are there to help. As for Moritz's comment that hiring women would involve lowering the firm's standards, Hart says, it certainly runs counter to what I'm experiencing. Adi Tatarko, CEO of the home design company Houzz, says her Sequoia investors have been very understanding of her working mom issues. For example, when she has to schedule around her son's birthdays and basketball games. I'm not trying to protect Mike Moritz or anyone else there or being diplomatic here, Tatarko says. I've had lots of discussions with them, and they are truly looking for more, to do more, to invest more, to support more, and bring more relevant women forward. Ultimately, Katrina Lake secured Series B funding for Stitch Fix from Benchmark, and one of its general partners, the acclaimed investor Bill Gurley, joined her board. Gurley discovered Stitch Fix via his assistant, who was spending an inordinate portion of her income on a personal styling service. As soon as he met Lake, he was impressed. She's nutty smart, Gurley told me in May 2016. 15 minutes into her presentation, he asked for more details on the startup's cash flow. She opened up her laptop and said, let's look, and she had a 3-year forward financial model, balance statement, income statement, and cash flow statement. I've never seen an entrepreneur do that in 20 years. Gurley said. In just a few years, Stitch Fix became one of the most promising e-commerce companies in Silicon Valley. In 2017, Stitch Fix filed for an IPO and revealed that it was profitable with $977 million in annual sales and about 6,000 employees. Other female entrepreneurs hoped Lake would prove to all venture capitalists that they should be investing in more women. That same year, however, a disturbing scandal made it clear that one insanely successful female founder would not change an entire industry. Not when that industry had a much bigger problem than it had ever admitted with male investors sexually harassing female entrepreneurs. And Lake was one of the most prominent victims. The Predators in VC. In 2013, an investor by the name of Justin Kaldbeck of Lightspeed Venture Partners led an early investment in Stitch Fix and became a board observer. Multiple sources who were close to Lake at the time say that Kaldbeck initially provided invaluable help to the promising startup, including recruiting new Stitch Fix executives. But at some point, he made Lake feel so uncomfortable that she asked Lightspeed to remove him from the board. The following year, Kaldbeck left Lightspeed, ostensibly because he wanted to start his own fund, Binary Capital. Lake was asked to sign a non-disparagement agreement, mandating that neither party ever speak of what happened. Jeremy Liu, a managing director at Lightspeed, told me, Justin was with us for a few years, he made some excellent investments, and we mutually decided he would not be part of Fund 10. That is, Lightspeed's next fund. To some industry insiders, that was code for, he got fired. Others I spoke to had never heard rumors of Kaldbeck's being disciplined for questionable behavior. Kaldbeck and his new partner Jonathan Teo were able to raise $125 million for Binary Capital's first fund, including a personal investment from Lightspeed partner Ravi Matre. Binary made several investments over the next 2 years. In the meantime, several female entrepreneurs discovered, by talking among themselves, that they weren't the only ones Kaldbeck had sexually harassed. Kaldbeck had walked on to the Duke University basketball team, got an MBA from Harvard, worked at McKinsey, Bain Capital Ventures, and then Lightspeed. He was once described to me as a walking LinkedIn, an investor who can make an introduction to anyone and everyone. He's an aggressive personality, one female entrepreneur told me. He gets deals done and gets to the right people. He's just a hustler. Turns out Kaldbeck didn't just hustle deals. In 2010, former Googler Ninian Wang started a co-working space for elite entrepreneurs called Sunfire. Sequoia, Benchmark, and other VC firms backed Sunfire in exchange for the opportunity to visit the office and interact with high-potential founders. Bain Capital Ventures, where Colbeck then worked, was also a sponsor and sent him as the firm's representative. Every Thursday, Sunfire held drinks at a nearby bar from 6 to 7 p.m. One day, Colbeck told Wang he wanted her opinion on a fashion startup and asked if they could discuss it in person after the weekly drinks, saying he had a meeting beforehand. By the time he arrived, everyone had left but Wang. When she started to talk about the startup, Colbeck stopped her. "Let's not talk about work," he said. He went on to grill her about her dating history and comment about outfits she had worn that he thought she looked good in. "He has to move to a booth," Wang told me. "He sat so his body was touching my body. At one point, I agreed to let him embrace me." When Colbeck drove her home, he kept pressuring her to let him spend the night. Finally, she says she managed to persuade him to drop her off and leave her alone. Wang said she felt ambushed. "I had no mental preparation that this could or would happen, so I hadn't at all emotionally prepared for what to do. It's a serious issue to terminate a relationship with a financial backer. I felt trapped. In a personal situation, I could say no more forcefully, but I was worried that it would have financial consequences for other people, including the other entrepreneurs who shared space at Sunfire." After that night, Wang said, Colbeck pursued her relentlessly, texting and calling at odd hours and suggesting they could have a secret relationship. "I just kept saying no, and then eventually he switched to sending me lots of work messages at inappropriate times." Colbeck continued to visit the workspace, which made Wang even more uncomfortable. She never reported Colbeck's behavior to Bain Capital, but later decided not to renew Bain's sponsorship. "I always worry that if I said anything, it would cause damage to others, not just to myself, but to others I cared about, and that always gave me a lot of pause," Wang says. Eventually, Wang confided in a fellow female entrepreneur and discovered that the other woman had also had an uncomfortable experience with Colbeck. "Oh, he's harassing me too," she said. A few years later, Wang heard about yet another woman with a Colbeck story. "I continued to hear rumors about other women," she said, "but Colbeck was getting away with it. There seemed to be no consequence," she told me. "His fund continued to get bigger and bigger. I knew that Justin was continuing to harass more women, and he seemed to be getting more and more bold." 7 years after her first encounter with Colbeck, she said, "I felt that I had to stop him." Wang told her story to Reed Albergati, a reporter at The Information, and spent hours persuading other women to speak to him as well. In all, 6 women came forward, alleging bad experiences with Colbeck, but none of them would allow Albergati to use their names. Wang says the editors at The Information decided they needed at least some of the women to speak on the record. "The only way to get this article published was to use my real name," Wang said. "I had nothing to gain and a lot to lose." Still, Wang concluded that her harassment by Colbeck had already been so painful that she was willing to suffer a little bit more to expose him. Plus, she was at a strong place in her career, having been a star at Google, the chief technology officer of the online design marketplace Minted, and more recently founded a company called Evertune. Wang decided she would go on the record and persuaded 2 other entrepreneurs to do so as well, Susan Ho and Leiti Su, the co-founders of the travel startup Journey, both of whom said they had been sexually harassed by Colbeck. After a fundraising meeting, Ho says Colbeck sent her a text message at 1 a.m. asking to meet up. She hesitated to meet with him again, but decided she had no choice. "We were in a place with our business that was make or break," Ho told me. Assuming safety in numbers, Ho asked Sue to accompany her. Midway through the meeting, Colbeck grabbed Sue's thigh under the table. "Like out of nowhere," Sue later recalled, explaining to me, "It was just like, wow, the trope of the wealthy, powerful Silicon Valley investor is real, the one that grabs your thigh." Sue says she casually shook his hand off. When The Information published the allegations against Colbeck, naming Wang, Ho, and Sue, the statements from Colbeck and Binary Capital were surprisingly confident. Colbeck said, "I strongly deny The Information's attacks on my character. The fact is, I have always enjoyed respectful relationships with female founders, business partners, and investors." Binary Capital said the allegations were false, and that while The Information had found a few examples which show that Justin has, in the past, occasionally dated or flirted with women he met in a professional capacity, let's be clear, There's no evidence that Justin did anything illegal, and there's no evidence that any of his investing decisions were affected by his social interests. In the hours after the article went live, the Silicon Valley Twitter sphere, which is normally quick to pile on, was quiet. Wang's worst fear that she would convince other women to risk their careers and no one would care seemed to be coming true. Some women did immediately back her. Sarah Lacey of Pando Daily wrote a post begging, "Where's the outrage?" Ellen Pao sent Wang a message applauding her bravery. When a few VCs tweeted condemnation of Kaldek's behavior, Pao retweeted them, adding, "We drive women out of tech if we don't speak up." The following day, Reid Hoffman spoke up in a big way with a lengthy blog post titled, "The Human Rights of Women Entrepreneurs." Hoffman wrote, "This is entirely immoral and outrageous behavior. So why the lack of outrage? Folks may think, well, that's bad behavior, but not my problem. If you think that and work here in venture, think again." Hoffman continued, "We all need to solve this problem. If you stay silent, if you don't act, then you allow this problem to perpetuate." In his post, Hoffman proposed something other women in tech had suggested to me, building an industry-wide HR function that would presumably govern interactions between investors and entrepreneurs and keep individual companies from burying allegations. He also asked that investors who stand against this behavior speak up online and include this hashtag, Decency Pledge. Several investors responded, including Roloff Botha of Sequoia, who tweeted, "At Sequoia, we support the Decency Pledge." Hoffman's call to action sent a strong message to female founders that they mattered and led to the airing of some of Greylock's own dirty laundry. Internally, it emerged that Greylock's COO, Tom Frangione, had an inappropriate relationship with a female employee. Within 3 days, Greylock investigated and Frangione was asked to resign. The firm called it a significant lapse of judgment that was inconsistent with its values. "If you're going to talk the talk, you have to walk the walk, and we all moved very quickly on it," Hoffman told me of the Frangione incident. He also says the partners held a meeting in which they told staff that if anyone knew of any more untoward behavior, they should feel comfortable enough to report it immediately. In the days that followed, the story of sexism in venture capital that I had been following for more than a year became a moving target. Several of the women who came forward were women of color. "It's fucked up and a bit dark," one female entrepreneur told me. "They're taking advantage of those who are the most vulnerable." Things everyone had whispered came out into the open. Investors, whom I had been tipped off about as being bad guys, were exposed. I had spent months trying to persuade women who had confided in me to go on the record. Most felt too ashamed, intimidated, or downright petrified to talk publicly. But after Kaldek's public takedown, my inbox was suddenly full of emails from women wanting to openly tell their stories about the investors who had invited them back to their hotel room, tried to kiss them, or even just made a creepy comment about their lipstick. They felt emboldened, empowered, and, to be frank, fed up. And slowly, the real story emerged that most women who have tried to raise money in Silicon Valley have not just one or two stories to tell about how someone made them feel uncomfortable, but too many stories to count. "Whether it be a snide comment or just a hug that's a little too grabby," Sue says, "this is just stuff that happens all the time." A week after the Kaldek revelations, Katie Benner at the New York Times published a story in which 24 women came forward about several different prominent investors. Susan Wu, a longtime entrepreneur, told the Times that she had had a bad experience not only with Kaldek, but also with the billionaire venture capitalist Chris Sacca, who she said had once touched her face at a party in a way that made her feel uncomfortable. Sacca preempted the article with a lengthy post that he published hours before the Times story broke that included the phrase, "I am sorry," 5 times. He later disputed Wu's particular account, but admitted that he had played a role in the industry's larger problem with sexism. "There's no doubt I said and did things that made some women feel awkward, unwelcome, insecure, and or discouraged," Sacca wrote. Another entrepreneur, Sarah Kunst, told the Times that Dave McClure, a co-founder of the early-stage venture fund 500 Startups, had also made unwelcome advances toward her. After talking to her about a potential job at 500 Startups, McClure sent Kunst a text message saying, "I was getting confused figuring out whether to hire you or hit on you." McClure also responded to the allegations with a long-winded apology. His was titled, "I'm a creep. I'm sorry." He said he had already been removed as CEO of 500 startups due to the allegations, but that he would remain at the company to focus on fiduciary obligations to investors. For the female CEO, Cheryl Yeoh, that apology fell short. She published her own account of how McClure, who was an investor in her company, got her drunk at a gathering of tech folk at her apartment. Of that night, Yeoh wrote, "Dave kept pouring scotch into my glass. Suddenly, everyone except Dave decided to order a cab. I quickly asked if Dave wanted to leave, like the rest of them, but he said no. Perplexed, I offered him to crash on the couch or the guest room and proceeded to show him to the guest room. Then I went into my own bedroom, but Dave followed me there, and that's when he first propositioned to sleep with me. I said no. At this point, I led him to the door and told him he needs to leave. On the way out, he pushed himself onto me to the point where I was backed into a corner, made contact to kiss me, and said something along the lines of, 'Just one night, please, just this one time.' Then he told me how he really likes strong, smart women like me. Disgusted and outraged, I said no firmly again, pushed him away, and made sure he was out my door." As Yeoh's post went live, a female partner resigned from 500 Startups, alleging the firm had tried to cover up the allegations against McClure. That same day, McClure left the firm for good. It was becoming clear that bad behavior in the industry had long been tolerated, ignored, or not taken seriously, and everyone wondered how many investors had yet to be exposed, how many never would be, and how many women would remain silent. Usually, the accused know so many more stories than what has been reported, because the people who come forward are the people who did not give in, did not have sex, Wang says. The VCs put out these heartfelt apologies, and people fall for it. You hear people say, "Well, he groped her, but it's not that bad." Well, it is that bad. Toward the end of the summer of 2017, the venture capital firm DFJ, originally named Draper Fisher Jurvetson, launched an independent investigation into alleged misconduct by one of its co-founders, Steve Jurvetson, a longtime friend of Elon Musk and a Tesla and SpaceX investor. Then, in October, female entrepreneur Carrie Krukel publicly posted on Facebook, "Women approached by a founding partner of Draper Fisher Jurvetson should be careful. Predatory behavior is rampant." Shortly thereafter, Jurvetson left the firm and took a leave of absence from the boards of Tesla and SpaceX. In a Facebook post, he said he had departed due to interpersonal dynamics with his partners and implied that the allegations involved personal rather than professional relationships. "It is excruciating to learn just how quickly, in one news cycle, people conclude that because I have left DFJ, there must be some credence to vicious and wholly false allegations about sexual predation and workplace harassment. Let me be perfectly clear, no such allegations are true," Jurvetson said. Whatever happened, men in technology were finally being held accountable. Just a few weeks later, I published a Bloomberg article in which multiple women claimed they were sexually assaulted or harassed by yet another prominent investor, Shervin Pishavar. In December 2014, Pishavar, an early Uber backer, attended the company's Roaring Twenties-themed holiday party with a pony wearing a Santa hat on a leash. But that wasn't the only stunt he allegedly pulled. Pishavar, then 40 years old, also approached Uber employee Austin Geit, then 30, put his hand on her leg and moved it up her dress, according to current and former colleagues. Geit squirmed away, the colleagues say. Pishavar, a major Democratic Party donor who raised money for President Obama and hosted a fundraiser with George Clooney for presidential candidate Hillary Clinton, was one of Uber's most influential backers. He maintained an especially close relationship to co-founder Travis Kalanick. Geit, who joined Uber as its fourth employee and its first woman, was in charge of launching the ride-sharing company in new cities at the time. A person with first-hand knowledge of Pishavar's behavior toward Geit confirmed the holiday party account. Though Geit declined to comment when the story broke, it's clear Pishavar was in a position of power. He had recently co-founded his own venture fund, Sherpa Capital, and the futuristic tube transportation company Hyperloop One. Pishavar, through his lawyer, denied the allegation and told Bloomberg that he and Geit always maintained a friendly and professional relationship. His representatives also directed us to speak with someone else who had attended the party and asked not to be named, who claimed that Pishavar couldn't have touched anyone that night because he had a drink in one hand and the pony leash in the other. The pony defense was widely mocked on social media. Five other women also told me that Peshawar used his influence to pursue unwanted sexual encounters with them, but declined to reveal their names, citing fears that he could retaliate and destroy their careers. One of the women, an entrepreneur, told me that Peshawar started hitting on her at a dinner meeting to discuss investing in her company, then forcibly kissed and groped her later in the evening. Another woman who works in the tech industry said she met Peshawar for dinner in 2013 to discuss career opportunities. He invited her back to his home, where she said, "He basically jumped on me, tried to put his tongue down my throat, and I stopped it." Also that year, a third woman, who Peshawar had hired to work for him, says he repeatedly tried to pressure her into having sex with him. Though she told him she wasn't interested in a romantic relationship, in a Facebook message shared with me, he booked one hotel room for the two of them on a trip. That's where she says he tried to perform oral sex on her until she convinced him to stop. "It felt really wrong and it was really confusing at the time," she told me. "I just remember his big body on top of me. I was young enough to be his daughter." At the Web Summit conference in November 2013, where Peshawar spoke on stage with Tesla CEO Elon Musk, a fourth woman says she went to an after-party that Peshawar had organized at a hotel. There, she said she found herself alone on the couch with Peshawar and another man. Peshawar, she said, was holding a phone, it's unclear who it belonged to, and was smiling as he was showing her photos of genitalia of women they claimed to have slept with. A fifth woman says Peshawar hired her company to work for him in 2015. He invited her to a party in Los Angeles, where, she said, he force-kissed her, then, in the weeks that followed, tried to bully her into dating him. In response to these allegations, Peshawar's representatives said, "We are confident that these anecdotes will be shown to be untrue." At the time, he was already in the midst of fighting press coverage of his arrest in London in May 2017, after a woman accused him of rape. London police say he was released under investigation, but not charged. His lawyer confirmed that Peshawar was detained briefly, but categorically denied the sexual assault allegation, saying, "He fully cooperated with the police investigation, which was exhaustive and detailed. In July, he was informed that no further action would be taken against him, and he was de-arrested, a British legal term." Peshawar also sued a so-called Republican opposition research firm that he accused of spreading false information about him in a smear campaign. The firm said it never conducted work on Peshawar and called his claims delusional. Within days of my original story, another female entrepreneur, Laura Fitton, alleged on the record that Peshawar had sexually assaulted and harassed her. Peshawar continued to deny these, quote, untruthful attacks, but resigned from Sherpa Capital. It was, by far, one of the most dramatic tales yet of misbehavior by powerful men in Silicon Valley. Justin Kaldbeck resigned from Binary Capital 3 days after the information article was published and updated his initial statement. "Obviously, I'm deeply disturbed by these allegations. While significant context is missing from the incidents reported by the information, I deeply regret ever causing anyone to feel uncomfortable. There's no denying this is an issue in the venture community, and I hate that my behavior has contributed to it." Binary Capital's fundraising was halted, and the firm effectively started to shut down, and Kaldbeck's partner, Jonathan Tao, who had initially supported him, also offered to resign. At the height of the scandal, Anne Lai, a former employee of Binary Capital, filed a lawsuit against the firm for post-resignation harassment. Lai said she left the firm because of a sexist environment that involved inappropriate conduct with other female staff members and routine comments about her attractiveness and that of female founders looking for funding. After her departure, she alleges in her lawsuit, the harassment began, and she presented to the court detailed messages in which Kaldbeck threatened to make sure she would never work again if she spoke poorly about the firm. She claimed that Binary also threatened to withhold her share of the profits from its investments. The suit also claims that Binary falsely told Lai's potential new employers that she had been fired for poor performance, and that Lai, who had 3 Harvard degrees, including a PhD in engineering, had trouble finding a job as a result. One doesn't have to look too closely at how Binary operated to figure out how the fund was run. Kaldbeck and Tao spent big to transform a former brewery into their new office, which featured a long marble bar. They wanted their office to look like a high-end club or residence. They didn't want it to feel like a traditional workspace, designer Ariel Ash told Architectural Digest in a feature about the new location. There's a focus on entertaining as they wanted to be able to throw parties in the space. Kalbeck and Teo were well known among entrepreneurs and investors as the party VCs who made frequent trips to Las Vegas. In fact, the pair met in Vegas while Kalbeck was dancing with Teo's executive assistant from Benchmark Capital, where Teo worked at the time. It was a match made in Sin City heaven. Someone close to the firm told me the partners had an informal rule that Kalbeck wasn't allowed to meet female entrepreneurs at a bar after 5:30 p.m. because he simply couldn't be trusted not to cross the line. Kalbeck denies this. The same person said that when Kalbeck was confronted about coming on too strong to certain women, he would mutter things like he had only asked her to dinner and chicks are so dumb. I've seen multiple sexually explicit text messages sent by Kalbeck to a woman he has harassed, in which he employs obscene language to describe pleasuring himself while thinking about her. As the Kalbeck saga unfolded, Recode added Katrina Lake's name to the list of women he had made uncomfortable. Lightspeed, his employer at the time, tweeted, "In light of what we have learned since, we regret we did not take stronger action." Lightspeed partner Ravi Matre immediately forfeited his original investment in Binary. 3 months after his resignation, I met Kalbeck with my colleague, Mark Millian, to ask about these charges. Kalbeck was somber and contrite and admitted that he had repeatedly screwed up, referring to his former self as unself-aware me. He said he was writing letters of apology to all of the women who had come forward, though he had yet to send them. He wouldn't comment on the record about specific allegations, including any interactions with Katrina Lake. A few days later, he followed up with a statement promising to become a beacon of accountability and help ignite honest self-reflection and positive change. His new mission would involve speaking to college students. Through intense therapy and lots of research on sexual harassment, I had a realization that behavior that's defined as sexual harassment in the workplace is common behavior amongst many college men. This behavior is often referred to as bro culture. My focus moving forward is to help eradicate the bro culture and create a positive change for women by elevating consciousness in men, Kalbeck said. I'd find such a mea culpa much more compelling if it had come before the public shaming. Was lots of research really necessary for such basic insights? His statement alone reveals just how cloistered and cut off certain powerful men in Silicon Valley can become. The folks who could force the VCs to change. While Lake also won't comment on her experience with Kalbeck, she raises a good point, that there are zero guidelines governing the relationship between venture capitalists and entrepreneurs. Typically, venture capital firms are too small to have a human resources department, and there's no industry code of conduct. VCs maintain that they're under pressure to behave appropriately because their entire careers rest on their reputations. If they do anything stupid, entrepreneurs will tell other entrepreneurs who won't want to take their money. The argument is that's enough to prevent bad behavior. But there's enough documented bad behavior to suggest that given the tremendous power differential between venture capitalists and the founders who desperately need their money, this disincentive has little effect. There's only one group of people in Silicon Valley who have more power than the VCs, enough power to punish them for bad behavior toward women. And that is the limited partners, LPs, the individuals and groups who provide the money that VCs dole out to everyone else. The only thing that VCs are measured on, their success, is 100% measured on returns, Lake told me. There's nobody who's holding them accountable to conduct business in a good way. They just need to make a lot of money for the LPs. How they do it matters less to the LPs. To explain, LPs fund VCs, and VCs fund entrepreneurs. Sometimes VCs invest a small portion of their own money into their portfolio companies, depending on the firm's policies. Either way, the money that LPs provide to VC funds is critical. This capital comes from pension funds, school and family endowments, high net worth individuals, hedge funds, and the like. Just as startups raise money from venture capitalists in exchange for equity, general partners, GPs, at VC firms, raise money from limited partners in exchange for the promise of big returns over a certain period of time, usually 10 years or so. Whether Binary's LPs knew of Justin Kalbeck's reputation is an open question. One LP faulted Lightspeed for not sharing the full story of his departure, but that person admitted the firm re-upped an investment in Binary even after hearing rumors about his falling out with Lake. Several LPs said they had approached Kalbeck about the rumors. When he denied them, they took him at his word. Another LP told my colleague Sarah McBride that over 36 reference calls were made about Kalbeck and Teo, And, quote, we have never had reference checks that were so enthusiastic. Some find this a little hard to believe. When I started writing this book, a full year before Wang stepped forward to the information, Kaldek's behavior was already an open secret. I sat down with Kirsten Green of Forerunner Ventures in 2016, long before the allegations against Kaldek were published. She told me simply, we don't do business with them. And she said she had told many LPs the same thing. When they raised that fund so fast, it was like, what? They're fun guys. Do fun guys help you raise a fund? In an environment where there's plenty of people to put your money with, I'm not sure why you need to put your money there. Canvas Ventures partner Rebecca Lin told me, I don't think all LPs knew, but I think some of them knew. They thought it was great he was in the party crowd. All these guys were known for a long time, and no one cared. You could have made a couple of phone calls, and you would have known. Part of the problem is that LPs themselves are competing to get their money into the best VC funds. From 2014 to 2017, venture investors in the United States raised $130 billion from LPs to deploy into startups. One LP told me, I just want the best GPs. I don't care who they are. I just want the best returns. Some of the best GPs aren't the best people, but they drive the best returns. When I started researching where the money comes from, I expected to learn that most Silicon Valley LPs were also white and male. I was surprised to find far more women sitting around the tables of limited partnerships than at venture capital firms. For example, the chief investment officers of many of the institutions with the most prestigious endowments are women, from the Smithsonian to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and they're not interested in policing the industry's bad boys. There are a lot of women in the LP community, but all of us would say the same thing, says Joelle Caden, founder of Accolade Partners, a limited partnership that invests in a variety of different venture firms, including Accel and Andreessen Horowitz, two firms that had no female investment partners as of 2017. Caden adds, we'd like to see more women at venture capital firms, but if you stuck a gun to our heads, we'd invest based on returns. Caden's job, after all, is to deliver returns to her own investors. When Caden and I spoke, Sequoia had just hired its first female partner, and Benchmark had yet to do so. It was in that context that Caden told me, part of the problem is those two firms have the best returns in the entire industry. What are you going to do? Not invest in them? I'd die to be in those funds. I wouldn't turn them down because they don't have a woman. I will do whatever it takes to have great numbers. Women going their own way. So, if the people funding the VC industry won't force change, the industry won't change unless it changes from within. These days, more women investors are taking matters into their own hands. When Aileen Lee worked at Kleiner, she was assigned due diligence on the firm's investment in the high-tech motorized scooter, the Segway, which, in retrospect, was greatly overhyped. She took herself for a spin and quickly realized the scooter had several drawbacks. It was expensive and required training to use, and there was nowhere to hang your purse, briefcase, or groceries. I had instincts leading me to believe the product wouldn't be a hit, Lee says. I wish I'd voiced those concerns more effectively, but I was working with such legends and I thought they knew better. Every investor has a list of woulda, shoulda, couldas, to be fair, but had Lee spoken up, she might have saved Kleiner a lot of money. That is, if the legends had listened. A few years later, Lee suggested the firm make a seed investment in a quickly growing ride-hailing company called Uber. At that time, however, Kleiner didn't typically invest at such an early stage. Later, she encouraged the partners to meet with Uber's then-CEO, Travis Kalanick, as he was raising the Series B, but there was little interest. Given the juggernaut that Uber became, despite its cultural issues, clearly this was a missed opportunity. Again, Kleiner later invested in Uber at a much higher valuation. Lee started to believe she might have more success by striking out on her own. With the blessing of Kleiner, Lee started raising money in 2012 for her own seed fund, Cowboy Ventures. Seed investing was a new, risky category, but Lee was optimistic she'd get enough money because she had built relationships with other investors who introduced her to the right LPs. Still, it wasn't easy. At one meeting, an LP asked whether she had kids. She replied that she had three. He was like, whoa, how is this going to work? Are you going to run the fund and have the kids? I'm like, no, I'm going to get rid of them, Lee joked. That particular fund ended up investing in Cowboy Ventures anyway. I was kind of torn. Should I take their money? They clearly have a weirdness about me being a working mom, Lee recalls. But she thought, I'm going to kick ass and maybe all their weirdnesses will go away. Lee's firm is in its early days, but she has been quietly building a well-respected brand. She even coined the now widely used term unicorn to refer to startups with billion-dollar exits. In 2016, she added her first unicorn to the Cowboy portfolio when the razor subscription startup Dollar Shave Club, which Lee had invested in initially at Kleiner and again at Cowboy, sold to Unilever for $1 billion. How did Lee manage to see the potential in a service that was mostly for men? You don't need men for razor deals and women for tampon deals, she points out. Still, while women like Lee are blazing new trails in venture capital, barriers remain to busting into one of the most exclusive boys' clubs in the business world. In 2014, a journalist got wind of a secret all-male club of venture capitalists called VC21, consisting of male partners from a variety of firms, including Kleiner, Excel, and Greylock. Once club members realized the press was on the scent, they invited a few female investors to join, and the bad PR was averted. VC21 was later rebranded as the Venture Social Club. An email to club members in March 2017 touted an all-expenses-paid stay at the Rosewood Hotel in Menlo Park and an over-the-top long weekend at the Montage on Maui, complete with sunset cruises, ocean fun, and private dinner experiences. Members have also told me of similar trips involving stays at spectacular mansions, sporting events such as heliskiing, ridiculous amounts of drinking, and elaborate dinners accompanied by $200 bottles of wine. All of this luxury is sponsored by various banks, law firms, and limited partners, all of whom want access to top deals. They've been sponsoring people for years, and they're paying for everything right down to the massages, says one member. These sponsors are footing the bill because a lot of business is getting done. The offhand gossip over drinks, the 10 minutes on a ski lift, all can have billion-dollar consequences. Chance encounters and opportunities unavailable to all the women who weren't invited into the club. On the club email chain, members discuss deal flow and congratulate one another on big exits. These messages involve a fair amount of backslapping, including bro-ish comments such as, you're the fucking man, drinks on you, and you're awesome, baller, one member explains. It's an atmosphere in which many women would feel uncomfortable. Still, it's great that some female VCs are now members. It's not so great that they have missed out on these networking opportunities for most of the last 10 years. When I asked female investors what they thought of the Venture Social Club, most just rolled their eyes. What it seems like from the outside is you have a country club that only invites certain members, one female VC said. I kind of say, fuck them. Then she reconsidered. Tell me what it's about and tell me it's not discriminatory and I'll think about it. All VCs know if they want to get ahead, they have to play the game that's on the field. Then again, maybe the game is starting to change. Kirsten Green of Forerunner was named VC of the Year by TechCrunch in 2017. She also invested in Dollar Shave Club and Jet.com, which was acquired by Walmart for $3 billion. And she doesn't fret too much that she'll miss opportunities because she's not hanging out with the guys. I don't want to be left out of deals because I'm not going on the guys' trip to wherever, but at the end of the day, I don't want to go on the guys' trip, Green says. Maybe we female VCs just need to have some of our own stuff. To that end, Green had recently bought a bunch of box seats to see the comedian Amy Schumer and invited other industry women. I think there are some really cool women in this business that I like a lot and want to do business with, she says. As for Aileen Lee, she now hosts an annual gathering of powerful women at her home where the husbands and partners of the guests don suits and pass out the drinks. At the most recent event, Chamath Palihapitiya kindly served me some sparkling water. In case her intentions weren't already clear, Lee dubbed the event Lady Fest. Chapter 6. Sex in the Valley. Men play, women pay. About once a month, on a Friday or Saturday night, a select group of the Silicon Valley technorati gather for a drug-heavy, sex-heavy party. Sometimes the venue is an epic mansion in San Francisco's Pacific Heights. Sometimes it's a lavish home in the foothills of Atherton or Hillsborough. On special occasions, the guests will travel north to someone's chateau in Napa Valley, or to a private beachfront property in Malibu, or to a boat off the coast of Ibiza, and the bacchanal will last an entire weekend or longer. The places change, but many of the players and the purpose remain the same. The stories I've been told by nearly 24 people who have attended these events or have intimate knowledge of them are remarkable in a number of ways. Many participants don't seem the least bit embarrassed, much less ashamed. On the contrary, they speak proudly about how they're overturning traditions and paradigms in their private lives, just as they do in the technology world they rule. Like Julian Assange denouncing the nation-state, industry hotshots speak of these activities in a tone that is at once self-congratulatory and dismissive of criticism. Their behavior at these high-end parties is an extension of the progressiveness and open-mindedness, the audacity, if you will, that makes founders think they can change the world. And they believe that their entitlement to disrupt doesn't stop at technology. It extends to society as well. However, few participants have been willing to describe these scenes to me without a guarantee of anonymity. Sex parties are just one aspect, albeit an impressively excessive one, of today's sexually open valley culture. Everyone, it seems, is experimenting with their sexual lives and relationships. A thriving hookup culture is fueled by apps such as Bumble and Tinder. Open relationships are common, and there's an active polyamorous community. For the large population of young, heterosexual men in tech making six figures, there's also the pay-for-sex scene that includes strip clubs, easy access to online escorts, and a new type of prostitution promoted by numerous sugar daddy websites where men pay women regular stipends for their companionship. If this activity was just relegated to personal lives, it would be one thing. But what happens at these sex parties, and in open relationships, and at strip clubs, as we'll see later, unfortunately, doesn't stay there. The freewheeling sex lives pursued by men in tech, from the elite down to the rank and file, have consequences for how business gets done in Silicon Valley. Sex parties of the tech and famous. From reports of those who have attended these parties, guests and hosts include powerful first-round investors, well-known entrepreneurs, and top executives. Some of them are the titans of the valley, household names, men whose faces have graced the covers of tech and business magazines. The female guests have different qualifications. If you're attractive, willing, and usually young, you needn't worry about your resume or bank account. Some of the women work in tech in the Bay Area, but others come from Los Angeles and beyond and are employed in symbiotic local industries such as real estate, personal training, and public relations. In some scenarios, the ratio of women to wealthy men is roughly 2-1, so the men have more than enough women to choose from. You know when it's that kind of party, one male tech investor told me. At normal tech parties, there are hardly any women. At these kinds of parties, there are tons of them. Over the last 2 years, numerous sources have told me that this culture has become rampant, though this has been the hardest chapter of this book to report by far. Many potential sources, especially women, abruptly canceled meetings with me the day of. Others asked me not to reveal their names, fearing retribution. Still, I believe there is a critical story to tell about how the women who participate in these events are often marginalized, even if they attend of their own volition. One female investor who had heard of this culture before I approached her told me, "Women are participating in these parties to improve their lives. They're an underclass in Silicon Valley." A male investor who works for one of the most powerful men in tech put it this way, "I see a lot of men leading people on, sleeping with a dozen women at the same time. But if each of the dozen women doesn't care, is there any crime committed? You could say it's disgusting, but not illegal. It just perpetuates a culture that keeps women down." To be clear, there is a wide range of parties for experimental sexual behavior, some devoted entirely to sex, maybe drug and alcohol free to encourage safety and performance, and demand a balanced gender ratio. Others are very heavy on drugs and women, and usually end in group cuddle puddles, a gateway to ever so slightly more discreet sexual encounters. The path by which women are lured into these sex parties differs. One female tech worker told me she fell into a high-flying, open-minded crowd after attending a party for the Bravo reality show about Silicon Valley. "I was invited to some villa in the city. I had just graduated from college, and it sounded cool and glamorous," she said. That took her on a series of unexpected adventures, including a sex party where several tech founders and engineers were in attendance and food was being served off the bodies of naked women. A few years later, this same woman met an investor who was trying to sell off some of his shares in a multi-billion dollar startup on the secondary market. She introduced him to prospective buyers and received a commission for her efforts. The pair started dating, and the investor took her to exclusive dinner parties, one of which ended up being a sex party. When I asked for more details, she grew quiet. Talking about these events to anyone on the outside, she said, is seen as the ultimate betrayal. Men show up only if directly invited by the host, and they can bring as many women as they want. But guys can't come along as plus ones. That would upset the preferred gender ratio. Invitations are shared via word of mouth, Facebook, Snapchat, perfect because messages soon disappear, or even basic paperless post. Nothing in the wording screams sex party or cuddle puddle just in case the invitation gets forwarded or someone takes a screenshot. No need to spell things out anyway. The guests on the list understand just what kind of party this is. Women, too, will spread the word among their female friends, and the expectations are hardly hidden. They might say, "Do you want to come to this really exclusive hot party? The theme is bondage," one female entrepreneur told me. "It's at this VC or founder's house, and he asked me to invite you." Perhaps this culture is just one of the many offshoots of the sexually progressive Bay Area, which gave rise to the desert festival of free expression, Burning Man, now frequented by the tech elite. Still, the vast majority of people in Silicon Valley have no idea these kinds of sex parties are happening at all. If you're listening to this and shaking your head saying, "This isn't the Silicon Valley that I know," you may not be a rich and edgy male founder or investor, or a female in tech in her 20s. And you might not understand anyway. Anyone else who is on the outside would be looking at this and saying, "Oh my God, this is so fucked up," one female entrepreneur told me. But the people in it have a very different perception about what's going on. This is how the night goes down. Guests arrive before dinner and are checked in by private security guards who will turn you away if you're not on the list. Sometimes the evening is catered, but at the most intimate gatherings, guests will cook dinner together. That way they don't have to kick out the help after dessert. Alcohol lubricates the conversation until, after the final course, the designer drugs roll out. Some form of MDMA, also known as ecstasy or Molly, known for transforming relative strangers into extremely affectionate friends, is de rigueur, including Molly tablets that have been molded into the logos of some of the hottest tech companies, such as Tesla and Snapchat. Some refer to these parties as e-parties. "People ingest Molly like candy during these events," says a woman who has partaken. Sometimes guests will mix the bitter powder with a fruity drink, or stir it into a coconut. MDMA is a powerful and long-lasting drug whose 1-2 punch of euphoria and manic energy can keep you rolling for 3 or 4 hours. "When you're on it, you feel like you love everybody," says one female entrepreneur. As dopamine fires, connections spark around the room and normal inhibitions drop away. People start cuddling and making out. These aren't group orgies, per se, but guests will break out into twosomes or threesomes or more. They may disappear into one of the venue's many rooms, or they may simply get down in the open. Night turns to day, and the group reconvenes for breakfast, after which some may have intercourse again. Eat, drugs, sex, repeat. These sex parties happen so often among the high-end premier VC and founder crowd that this isn't a scandal or even really a secret, I've been told. It's a lifestyle choice. "This isn't Prohibition or the McCarthy era," people remind me. "It's Silicon Valley in the 21st century. No one has been forced to attend, and they're not hiding anything, not even if they're married or in a committed relationship. They're just being discreet in the real world. Many guests are invited as couples, husbands and wives, boyfriends and girlfriends, because open relationships are the new normal. While some parties might be devoted primarily to drugs and sexual activity, others may boast just pockets of it, and some guests can be caught unawares. In June 2017, one young woman, let's call her Jane Doe, received a paperless post invite for a party on the edge of the earth. The invite requested Glamazon adventurer, safari chic, and jungle tribal attire for the party to be hosted at Casa Jervy by the Sea, the home of venture capitalist Steve Jurvetson, in the resort beach town of Half Moon Bay, south of San Francisco. It turned out that this was the after-party for his venture capital firm DFJ's Big Think Unconference, an exclusive gathering for folks in the tech industry. But two invites went out for the same event, a moody, provocative paperless post invite, tiger and all, and then a separate official email from Jurvetson's firm. This second invite was a straightforward email from DFJ inviting guests to a daytime retreat that included expert